the wisdom to share with us. A wisdom that is not of our making, a wisdom that we cannot fully fathom even with our most sophisticated scientific instruments, and a wisdom that we ignore at our own peril and at the peril of all things around us. I'm going to begin, partly I guess inspired by the young children that are here, to share a couple of stories that I shared with the children at Narnia this morning. And the first one is the story that's called Old Man Coyote and Grandfather Rock. But we need a little introduction. You need to know that among the Sioux people, the Lakota people, there is the belief about creation that at the beginning, all things existed only in the mind of Wakantanka. And when the spirits were released to find a place to live, they traveled to find a place for creation to begin. And they traveled to the sun, but the sun was too hot. And so finally, they traveled to the earth. But the earth was covered with water, and nothing could live here. Until out of the sea, there came a large burning rock. And when that burning rock rose up out of the water, then land could be deposited on the rock, and life could begin. And that rock was called Tunkashila, Grandfather Rock. And this is a story about Old Man Coyote, who is a kind of trickster who never quite gets things right. He's always getting into mischief and sometimes is known to try and play a little fast and loose with the truth in order to get out of a tough jam. Old Man Coyote was traveling along, and he became so hungry, he felt like he was cut in half. And he came to Grandfather Rock, and he told Grandfather Rock, "If you help me find some food, I'll give you my fine flint knife." And he laid his knife down on Tunkashila, Grandfather Rock. And he turned around and he walked down the hill. And at the bottom of the hill, he found a buffalo that had just been killed, just waiting to be eaten. And he thought to himself, "How am I going to cut up and eat this meat without a knife? I wonder what I did with my knife." You think he really forgot? I don't know. He went back to Grandfather Rock and he said, "You're just a rock. You don't need a knife. I have to cut this meat. I'll just take my knife. Thank you." And he turned and went down the hill. But when he came to the bottom of the hill, all he found was a bunch of old bones. They were all dried up and dead. And then Old Man Coyote heard a sound. And what was that sound? Gadarum, gadarum, gadarum. And he looked up. And here was this big rock rolling down the hill toward him. Gadarum, 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 gadarum. He went by the bear's den and he called out, "Help me." The bear said, "You've made Grandfather Rock angry. We're not going to mess with him. You're on your own." And the rock, gadarum, 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 gadarum. Went by the lion's den, called out to the lions, "Grandfather Rock is trying to kill me." The lion said, "We're not messing with Grandfather Rock. You're on your own." And the rock kept coming closer and closer and closer. Gotta run, gotta run, gotta run, gotta run, gotta run. And he came to a buffalo. Old Man Coyote, even as desperate as he was, thought he had a plan. So he called out to the buffalo. "Grandfather Rock said that he was going to kill all the buffalo. I told him he shouldn't do that, and he got mad at me, and that's why he's after me. Well, Buffalo, being a noble beast, you know, decided to stand there. He stood right in the path of the rock and planted his feet and bent his head. And that old rock came up and hit him just like that, right in the head. He glanced off. Man, that rock, it just curved his horns, bent his horns like that, shoved his head right back into his shoulders like that. You ever seen a buffalo? That's the way they are to this very day. Anyway, by now, Old Man Coyote was really getting scared. And he thought he was a goner. And all of a sudden, he saw a magpie. And so he called out to the magpie. He said, "Grandfather Rock is trying to kill me. He said all magpies are ugly. Pinched beak, funny eyes bulging out. The ugliest bird in the world." And I told him he shouldn't say that about my friends, the magpies. He got mad at me, and that's trying to kill me. So the magpies got together, and they flew one by one to the rock. And as their beak struck the rock, a little piece flicked off. And the rock kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And finally, it was just a pile of pebbles. Old Man Coyote thought he was safe. Kind of wiped his brow. He looked at his friends, the magpies, and he said, "My goodness, why did you ugly, pinched beak, eyes bulgy birds do that to my friend Tonkashila, Grandfather Rock?" And Old Man Coyote laughed, and he walked away. And the magpies flew to that pile of stones, and they began to flap their wings. And pretty soon, those pieces of stone began to come together, and there was a rock again. And pretty soon, Old Man Coyote heard a familiar sound. And what was that? Gadda-rum, 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 gadda-rum. And this time, he had run out of tricks. And old Grandfather Rock just rolled over him and smashed him just as flat as a pancake. He lay there just like a pancake, just with a little tuft of a tail sticking up in the air. Of course, we know it didn't kill Old Man Coyote. I mean, within a week or two, he was up and around and kind of feeling a little sore and a little bruised, like he'd been on a long, difficult hike. But he was back into mischief sooner than you could ever believe. You'd think he had learned his lesson, but he didn't. That's Old Man Coyote and Grandfather Rock. It's a story to take just a moment to think about Old Man Coyote and Grandfather Rock. It's an interesting story because it really speaks about what happens when all we think about is our own needs, when we really do not respect the commitments that we've made to other living things. When we look at a rock and we say, it's just a rock. You don't need this. I'll just take it because I know I need it. It's a story that really tells us that all of our actions have consequences. There's a price to be paid when you betray creation. And that it's maybe not too realistic for us to turn back to creation to ask creation to bail us out when we made those kind of statements. One of the other stories that we told today was a story about the elephant and the hummingbird. The elephant was walking along one day through the jungle. Boom, 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 boom. And all of a sudden, he saw his friend Hummingbird. But little Hummingbird was laying on his back. He has little feet up in the air like that. And the elephant thought that was kind of strange. He said, "How come you've got your feet up in the air?" Do you remember what Hummingbird said? What did he say?
I heard that the sky was going to fall today, so I got my feet up there to hold up the sky. The elephant thought that was the most ridiculous thing in the world. He laughed so hard the floor of the jungle just shook for miles around. You think you can hold up the sky with your tiny little feet? What did the hummingbird say? Yeah, he said, not by myself. But everybody has to do what they can. And this is what I can do. Now, I can't say for sure, but I heard that later that day, the sky did begin to fall. But it was held back by the amazing sight of millions of little hummingbird feet standing up in the air. And almost more amazing, right in the middle of all those hummingbird feet were the four amazing That little story, by the way, is from China, and it's a part of a book called Peace Tales, which is in the bookstore, and it's all full of wonderful stories that sort of deal with peace and peacemaking. And the next topic that will be discussed in my next session is going to be called Brer Possum's Dilemma, and that's all about peace tales. Peace stories that talk to us about peacemaking. And some of those stories will be taken from this little book. Story of Grandfather, Old Man Coyote and Grandfather Rock is from a wonderful collection of Native American stories collected together by Joseph Brujac, who is a very much respected Native American collector of stories and other lore from the Native American peoples around the country. And it's a selection that is not just from one tribal tradition, but really is taken from groups all over North America, not only in America, but also Native Americans from, or Native Canadians also. So it's a wonderful collection that you might want to take a look at. Today, my topic is listening to the turtle. And this is a topic that comes from not the famous children's book. I'm sure some of you probably know about Old Turtle, the book Old Turtle. It's a much loved and much read story, which sort of pictures all creation sort of arguing together. They get into a theological argument. And all the various parts of creation begin to argue about what God is like. And finally, from the top of the mountain comes this big, deep voice of Old Turtle, who really kind of calls them to stop their bickering and to think about, you know, what God is really like. And God is like all of the things that they've been talking about and much more. And it's a beautiful, interesting book. But my title comes not from Old Turtle, but from a true story. A story that happened just a few blocks down the road from where I live in Madison, Wisconsin. A few years back, about, I think it's 5 or 6 years ago, there was a developer that was going to come in and put in a big development near Middleton, Wisconsin, which is a suburb of Madison. Going to build a lot of houses, and he's going to make a lot of money. But one of the things that they had to do was to build a wide road right through a section of Middleton, in which there was a beautiful pond called Stryker's Pond. And it had been a very quiet, tranquil neighborhood with lots of children. And so the people in that neighborhood began to get together and discuss what would happen to their neighborhood if they had a big, busy highway coming through their neighborhood. And what would happen to Stryker's Pond, where there were turtles and ducks and geese certain times of the year, and a pond that had tadpoles and frogs and all kinds of
a wildlife. And there was one lady that was particularly concerned about this and thought they ought to do something. And she did a strange thing. She decided to go down to Stryker's Pond and ask the pond for some advice. She went down there, literally walked down to the pond and talked to the pond and expressed their concerns and their thoughts and really asked the pond to give them a sign of what they were to do. I'm sure she must have felt a little foolish talking to a pond. I don't know if any of you have ever talked to a pond, but she felt that somehow, since the fate and the future of Stryker's Pond was in the balance, that somehow Stryker's Pond ought to be brought into the dialogue. The pond really ought to be asked if it had anything to contribute to that consideration. On the day that the Middleton City Council was going to decide whether or not to begin a lawsuit to prevent this development, a strange thing happened. A painted turtle climbed out of Stryker's Pond and walked across the road into this lady's front yard and dug a hole and made a nest and laid 18 turtle eggs in that nest, covered it up, walked back to Stryker's Pond. Fortunately, this lady and her husband had a video camera. So they got a chance to, when they realized what was going on, they had a chance to photograph about 3 or 4 minutes of that mother turtle laying those eggs in their front yard. That night, the Middleton City Council met, and there were all kinds of eloquent arguments raised on both sides of the question, because there was serious money involved and some prospects for development that were to be taken seriously. Then they brought out the video in the closing moments of the discussion, and they showed 3 minutes of a mother turtle laying her eggs in one of their front lawns. And it turned the tide. The council voted by a fairly substantial vote that they would take steps to prevent that development from taking place. 18 months later, that case finally came to the judge for decision. That afternoon, when the children were coming home from school, their bus pulled up on their quiet street, and as they got off the bus, those turtle eggs began to hatch. 14 turtles climbed out of those turtle eggs. And that evening, or that day, the judge rendered the initial decision preventing the development from taking place. The case was appealed and eventually went all the way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, where in the final analysis, the inhabitants of that neighborhood were upheld in their claim. And I simply tell you this story. I don't know what this story means. I don't know what turtles know about issues of development or the economics of the economy of Middleton, Wisconsin. I don't know what turtles know about the Wisconsin judicial process or when judges do or do not make decisions. Those are all questions that I'm fairly vague about. But the question I'd like to throw out to you is, what do you think was going on here? What do you think this turtle was saying? What can we conclude from this? Any thoughts? What was going on here?
Thank you.
What can we say with a fair amount of certainty the turtle will sing?
This is my home.
What?
This is my home.
Okay. Certainly, at the very least, the turtle was saying, this is my neighborhood too. And it's a neighborhood in which the future of my children is as important to me as the future of your children is to you. At the very least, that was being said in this particular kind of incident that took place. It's an interesting thing. It kind of raises the issue that I just want to plant in your minds, and I don't have any solution to it. I'm just a storyteller. But I think I could say without fear of contradiction that this group that's gathered here tonight recognizes that we need the earth. And we have not been kind to the earth. And maybe, it's just a question, maybe we need to ask the earth to show us a better way. Natural people did that. Natural people listened to the rocks and the trees and the animals around them. Among native peoples, they would never think of making an important decision without consulting the voice of Grandfather Rock, the voice of the created order around them. And they believed that they were given trustworthy guidance when they listened attentively and in a mindful way to what creation had to say to them. One other story. I don't know if there's anybody, and I haven't had a chance to check this one out, is there anybody here from the San Francisco area or around that area at all? Have you heard of a mountain not far from San Francisco called Mount Telepus or something?
Telepias.
I heard a story about Mount Telepias.
Tamil.
What is it?
Tamil Pai.
Okay. Several years back, there were a number of tragic murders that took place in the vicinity of that mountain. And there were, in fact, I believe, 4 or 5 women that were raped and murdered within the shadows of that mountain, or on the mountain itself. And at that time, that whole community was gripped with fear, as we might well imagine. There was a woman named Anna Halprin. I don't know if you've heard of Anna Halprin, but she was actually a dancer and a choreographer. And she decided that this mountain and this community was in need of healing. And she wondered how this could be accomplished. And then someone told her about a tradition of the Miwok Indians, that they had a tradition of the sleeping maiden that lived in the mountain. And according to this ancient Miwok legend, one day the sleeping maiden would be awakened, and she would come down from the mountain, and the mountain would be healed. And so Anna gathered together a troupe of actors and dancers, friends that she had come to know, and she composed and choreographed the story of the sleeping maiden from that Miwok legend. It was performed first on stage in San Francisco, and later they performed that dance on the side of the mountain. And then she heard from an old shaman from another Indian group that had heard of what she was doing on the mountain. And the old shaman came to her and told her that according to their understanding of such things, in order for the mountain to be cleansed, this rite would have to be done for 5 years. And so for 5 years in succession, this dance interpretation of this old Miwok legend was performed. on the side of that mountain. And at the end of the first performance, within days of the first performance, that first year, a man was arrested and charged with a crime. He was convicted 5 years later when that choreographed ritual of the cleansing of the mountain had been completed. And now they do that same ritual from time to time. If you're in that area, it apparently is still being done from time to time. But now it is no longer for the cleansing of that mountain, but it is now being done for the cleansing of the whole earth and the healing of all the world's peoples. It is a strange story, and I don't know what it means. I'm just a storyteller. Yes?
Did he ever come down?
Pardon?
Did he ever come down?
No one ever saw her that I know of. But many people felt that she did come down. And that's why the mountain was healed and cleansed. It's one example of a gifted and educated person who had a deep respect for the wisdom of the earth and the wisdom of natural peoples who live close to the earth. And she used the stories and the rituals of the Miwok Indians to guide her in trying to bring healing to Mount Calliopus and to her community. Now, the results of this are certainly subject to different interpretations. I mean, what happened? I don't understand that. I do know that there was something significant and important in that moment when there was a community that was gripped with fear, that something had to be done to bring healing to that community. And people stepping forward and using their creative talents and using their respect and care for the earth and the respect for the wisdom of natural peoples, that acting that out had something to do with accomplishing the healing and the restoration of that community and that mountain. And there's something going on there that I have the feeling that you and I need to learn something about. One of the things that I wanted to share with you tonight is a story that I wanted to show you in a video. There's a farmer that lives in Austin, Minnesota. His name is Michael Cotter. And if you ever have a chance to listen to Michael Cotter tell stories, you know, I hope you won't pass it up. He's a wonderful storyteller. And it's because he loves the land, and he understands the land, and he understands a lot about, you know, how we live on the land. And I'm just going to show you a short little story, but we're in the wrong room. We don't have the little black box to look at this little video of Michael Cotter telling this story. And so we have to use our imagination. You have to imagine this man who has a kind of a square jaw and a rather lined face. You can tell he's been outside a lot and has, you know, sat on the machinery and been out on the fields a lot. And he has this kind of strange little timid smile that plays across his face every now and then. And Michael Cotter, in that little story, tells about the mother killdeer. And he says he was out there one day with this huge tractor, you know, one of these with the big dual tires, and, you know, I don't know, any farmers here that can tell me how big these tractors get? You know, 1,000? How many horsepower these biggest tractors are that the farmers use today? But he was in this huge air-conditioned, you know, tractor with all the gadgets and everything, and behind him was this huge big disc. He was beginning to work up the fields. And he was driving along this drainage ditch. And these farmers have dug these drainage ditches, and down in the bottom of the ditch is a drainage tile. And then going out from there, these lines snake out to drain the land so they can farm the land. And he's going along with this huge machinery, and all he can hear is the roar of the machinery, and he can see the dust rolling up. And then out of the corner of his eye, he sees a mother killdeer. And if you know anything about the killdeer bird, right close to the ground among the rocks. You can't even tell them from the rocks sometimes. And the mother killdeer, when danger comes, you know what the mother killdeer does? When danger comes to the nest, the mother killdeer will go into this act. She'll drag one wing like that, and she'll kind of hop along, and you know, to try and lure someone away from the nest. And Michael Cotter saw this mother killdeer going into her act, dragging one wing and kind of scuttling off to the side. But he had no idea where the nest was. And finally, the mother killdeer was beginning to get frantic and dragging both wings and flopping and turning over in the dust. He knew he was close. And so finally, he stopped his machinery. He just shut the big old tractor down. He sat there inside the cab, and he said, "Mother killdeer, you're going to have to show me where that nest is." The mother killdeer hesitated for a little while, and then she trotted over and settled on the nest. And he could see where it was. And he hit his hydraulic lift, lifted up the big drag, and slowly rode over the mother killdeer. And he was amazed when he shut down that big tractor of how much he could hear. He could hear the water running in the drainage ditch. He could hear the birds singing. He could hear the sound of the wind playing across the land. But after he had gone over that nest, he remembered that he's a farmer, and time is money. And there are many acres to be plowed that day. And so he set the disc down, started up the engines, and put the machine in gear, and started down the field. And he looked over his shoulder, and he could see the dust rolling off his big tires. And through the dust, he could see the faint outline of the mother killdeer. And he knew that his time with the mother killdeer was over. It's, I think, an unusual story. It's a story that reminds us of how even loving the land and even having a love and concern for the wild creatures that share the land with us, that sometimes just the necessities of our life put us inside a big cab and at the wheels of a machinery that by its very nature will mean that at some point we separate ourselves from those living creatures around us. And I think Michael Cotter was trying to communicate to us that the poignancy and even the pain of that moment when in a sense he felt compelled to say goodbye to the mother killdeer and her nest. A while ago I came upon a magazine. It's one that I recommend very highly if you're interested in stories and especially myths and legends. It's a magazine called Parabola. It's a beautifully well done magazine. It's a little expensive. It costs, I think, $6 an issue. But it's full of wonderful articles and stories about how myths and legends and stories are providing insight and guidance to people. And in the summer issue of Parabola magazine, there's an article by a man named Scott Sanders, who has just finished a book that's called Staying Put. This is not in the bookstore. In fact, it just came out about a month ago. And I just want to share just a little bit about what Scott Sanders has to say about our relationship to the land, and also, because it's of interest to me, and I hope to you, about how stories play into that. Scott Sanders said, I have had, by the way, the title for his article is Telling the Holy. Not listening to the sacred, but telling the holy. But those two titles belong together like hand and glove. He said, I have had to move away from beloved places, from landscapes and towns that shaped me. Yet I remain attached to those places by the threads of stories. Thus, a river long since dammed still runs in me because one winter dawn, while checking muskrat traps, I slipped into the chill current and nearly drowned. A field of wildflowers blooms in me because of a woman who lived there alone in a cabin once filled my young palm with flower seeds. A street shines in memory with the red hair and pranks of a neighbor boy who suffered seizures and was a childhood friend. In memory, a forest I have not seen for 20 years still murmurs with the voice of my father naming trees. A pasture gleams under the hooves of horses. A beach dimples in my memory under the footsteps of my wife. I am bound to the earth by a web of stories, as I am bound to creation by the very substance and rhythms of my flesh. By keeping the stories alive, I keep the places themselves alive in my imagination. Living in me, born in mind, these places make up the landscape on which I walk, even when my feet are still. Traditional peoples distinguish between the tales of the everyday world and the tales of the spirit world, between history and myth, profane and sacred. Sacred stories arise from the intuition that beneath the flow of creation there is order, within change there is permanence, within time eternity. Everything moves, yet everything is shapely. The Apache word for myth means literally to tell the holiness. By telling holy, sacred stories, ground a people or an individual not merely in a landscape, but in the power that creates and preserves the land. The Apache story tells us that the plants, the rocks, fire, water are all alive. They watch us and see our needs. They see when we have nothing to protect us, and it is then that they reveal themselves to us and speak to us. He also goes on to talk just briefly about the kinds of stories that we shared with the children today. He said, in the beginning, storytellers tell us humans and animals could speak to one another as familiarly as God spoke with Adam and Eve in the garden, and as the snake spoke to Eve in the garden. I often wondered how that conversation took place. You ever thought about that? Did Eve speak snakeese, or did the snake speak human language? Either one would be a pretty impressive feat. on the part of the individuals involved. Anyway, Scott tells us that the lore of many lands is filled with helpful coyotes or cats, talkative serpents or swans, wise lions and crafty crows. Even the villains, the dragons and the wolves, are garrulous. Now and then a wild poet comes along like William Blake and still converses with tigers, or a shaman like Black Elk may converse with a bison. But the rest of us have forgotten the universal language. Our ears have been stopped up. Our lips have been sealed. According to the Hindus, God speaks Sanskrit. According to the Jews, God speaks Hebrew. According to one people after another, God speaks the language of the tribe. What God speaks, I humbly submit, is the universe. But since nobody has supplied us with a cosmic dictionary, we have been laboring word by word over 1,000 generations to compile one for ourselves. He also goes on to shift the gears. He talks about his experience as a boy of growing up in Ohio. And he went to help a farmer named Sivey collect buckets of maple syrup. He had a grove of maple trees, and every year they would go out and tap the maple trees for maple syrup. And they would empty the buckets into a barrel that rode on a sledge pulled by twin draft horses. Mr. Sivey said he preferred horses because the noise of the tractor would have disturbed the trees. It certainly would have disturbed Mr. Sivey, who spoke to a team of dappled gray percherons with clicks of his tongue and soft words. As we worked, he told me tales about the horses, about the maples, about the river that muscled through his farm, about the clouds, the frogs, the thawing dirt. Here's what the soil needs, he told me. Here's what the rains do. Here's what the dogwood and larkspur say about the condition of the woods. All his actions, from plowing to pruning, were informed and constrained by what he knew of his place. Until the government built a dam and flooded Mr. Sivey's farm, every year the maples yielded their sap without diminution. Every year the soil was richer, the pastures were thicker, the birds more abundant. He lived well on his piece of earth because he was married to it by narrative as well as by nature. So might we marry ourselves to a place, commune with other creatures, and make ourselves at home through stories. He has one other thing to share with us that I wanted to share, and then we'll take a break and give you a chance to kind of respond or raise thoughts or questions. He was an avid reader of a man named Bruce Chatwin. I don't know if you're familiar with Bruce Chatwin, but he's written a wonderful book, which I promptly checked out of the library, called Songlines. And Bruce Chatwin went down and spent much time down in Australia, and particularly among the Aboriginal native peoples. And he writes about the thoughts that Bruce Chatwin shares with us. And he indicates, he says, in telling the holy, we do not acquire power as one might gather coins into one's purse, but we acknowledge it, join with it, and dwell in the power. The Aborigines of Australia believe that they help to renew the world by recalling stories and singing songs from the beginning time. They call that beginning time the dreaming. They believe that that the world began in this dreaming time, and that reality was the dreaming of the great spirits. And that they follow what they call dreaming tracks. Australia is crisscrossed by the dreaming tracks that the Aboriginal people have walked down on their spiritual quests for generations. Their dreaming tracks are the paths they walk and the tales they tell, paths of footsteps and narrative drawn on the land. They participate in the ongoing work of nature by reaffirming creation. In Aboriginal belief, Bruce Chatwin reports, an unsung land is a dead land, since if the songs are forgotten and the stories are forgotten, the land will die. To allow that to happen is the worst of all possible crimes. As we walk on our own ground, on foot or in mind, we need to be able to recite stories about the hills and the trees, the animals and the rocks. Stories that help to root us in this place and keep it alive. The sounds we make, the patterns we draw, the plots we trace may be as native to the land as the deer trails or the bird songs. The more fully we belong to our place, the more likely that our place will survive without damage. We cannot create myths from scratch, but we can recover or fashion stories that will help us to see where we are, how others have lived here, and how we ourselves should live. I'd like to give you an opportunity to respond, to raise questions, or some of you may have been here for my first session. At the end of the session, I asked you to think about a place that is really treasured to you, a place that really means something, to think about that place and maybe what the sights and sounds and smells are of that place, and maybe things that you might have experienced that might help you to be kind of married to that place in the sense that Scott Standers is talking about. Just wondered if anybody here has anything they'd like to share, any comments or questions.
I have an answer about the animals and people talking together.
Yes.
In the Bushman's story of creation, the thing that makes it paradise is that people and animals can understand each other. And the way I've always understood the story, it wasn't that they talked a specific language, but that everybody was able to understand everybody's language. Mm-hmm. And the breaking of the commandment brings the end of that.
Yes?
I have a special place that I
Okay. Out
in my backyard. There's a stump, and behind it, it's where the hedge ends, and next to it is an old
Yeah, good. Is that a place just to kind of sit and think, or to? That's nice. Anybody else have a little treasured place? Interesting thing to think about. Thoughtful looking group here.
I have a place, it's Dakota Prairie, waving fields of grain and a stream flowing through, and a little country road, you know, with the kind of dirt with the grass strip kind of curving on it.
Now, when did you live there? Or?
Well, when I was a boy, I spent a lot of summers at my grandfather's farm.
Have you been able to, you get back there from
time? Yeah, I do.
And the place still feels kind of...
Yeah, some of it's changed, but, you know, it's in my memory, so I can call it up whenever I need to.
Oh, excuse me, yes. Golden Village. Do you know why that's kind of so special for you?
No, because it's a quiet place where you could think of everything, so remember things that you can remember.
I think that's, you know, one of the things that Scott Sanders was talking about, that if we can remember in our imagination things that we've experienced in a place, and you know, whether it's standing in line to get an ice cream cone. I was just thinking this afternoon, why do they make it so difficult for us to get an ice cream cone? I'm sure that there's a more efficient way to dispense ice cream, but what I was thinking about, I was standing in this long line and looking forward so much to that ice cream cone, and really thinking to myself, maybe that's the point. You know, I mean, this is the only place on the face of the earth where I yearn for this. You know, I mean, it's a treasure, and it's waiting there at the end of the line. And, you know, I mean, if we could just waltz in there and, you know, give me an ice cream cone and waltz out again, I don't think it would have the same meaning. I just have that feeling that there's something special about the way they do things.
Is the anticipation more than the realization?
By the way, since I have... Oh, go ahead, yes.
I have a favorite place.
Okay.
That may seem strange to a lot of people. I was born in Chicago, Illinois, mm-hmm. in 1933. For 55 years, I had always wanted to see my birthplace. I left it when I was 4 years old and only had a visual picture of it. 5 years ago, we were at my parents' 60th wedding anniversary, and I said I wanted in Minneapolis, I want to go to Chicago to see if I can find my birth home. That I heard so much about. This birth home was in sort of a downtown area of Chicago. All the way across the country, this anticipation built more and more. What was I going to find? We came in on the interstates, found our way down to this, I wish I could remember the address of that. But we found we had to go across one street, Main Street, that was very run down. And we thought, boy, what are we going into? We went down that street, finally came to the point where I had to turn left to go two more blocks to get over to the street where the church, my birth home, the church was downstairs. My birth home was upstairs. That was the parsonage. We found this place. Mm-hmm. Went up to it. All the doors were locked. We could tell people were still living. It was still used as another type of church, not a Lutheran church anymore. And we knocked on this door. No, or rang a doorbell, that's what it was. One door went into the church, one door went up the stairway to the parsonage. I could not remember any of this. We rang the doorbell from the parsonage. Stood there for a while, and all of a sudden a head came off the window. May I help you, sir? It was a Negro gentleman. And I told him, I said, I have, after 55 years, found my birth home. That I did not know or remember. And what an experience. This man said, come in. And what an experience that was to have, I don't know, I guess you could say it's a favorite place for me. Mm-hmm. But I had not seen it in 55 years.
So part of a hunger.
And he took us through this place. And he says, come down in the basement. Here's this old gas cook stove that your mother cooked on for church functions. Here's an old ice box that we used to have for ice for church functions. And he took us through all the rooms. And it was an amazing experience. Favorite place that I'll never forget to this day.
Yes.
His saying birth home reminds me of a favorite story of mine of told by Gilles Healer called The Storm Home. And it's a story about when he was growing up in Minnesota in school. He was a country kid and they would assign them a house in town where the country kids would go in case of a storm, a winter storm. And he knew which was his storm home and the people that lived there. But even though there was never a storm that necessitated him going there, it was a place he dreamed about a lot, fantasized about what it would be like. Mm-hmm. And he said it made his whole life a lot easier growing up as a teenager, knowing that if things ever really got bad, he always had his storm, home.
It's a beautiful thought. I'd like to, okay.
I can give you a quick answer on that ice cream.
Okay.
I was on the other side of that counter this afternoon. The pay is great.
I heard that.
The ice cream is so hard. So there are a few times I offered to scoop to the people that were wanting the cones so we could go faster. We tried.
Yeah, I know you do.
But I sure had a good time. Even though you had to wait. And the manager, you know what's interesting? The manager of that place is, Conrad, quit harassing the customer and serve ice cream.
Yeah.
I had so much fun.
That's the only place I've ever gone to where yesterday I had a root beer float and they filled the glass with ice cream and then all root beer went in it and then they handed me a glass half full of root beer. They said, this is to top off your float. So it's worth waiting for. Yes.
I was just going to raise the question of saying, preface it by saying I think stories are very important, and as a person who enjoys writing stories, I see the value. However, I think there's a tension, and I think that you just mentioned that there's a hungering. And I think stories, because they are so powerful, we attach more power to them than we really should at times, for the sake that we lose perspective of where the power is. And we place the power in remembering something back or in an experience. And then we attach, I think it was in your title, wisdom to it. And there seems to be a real tension between that and Scripture, wisdom. We lost the notion by the New Testament. The people as they went into Canaan are warned, don't pick up those myths, don't live on with those stories, the fertility gods, leave that stuff alone. If you want to say something about that, I apologize,
sure.
We're running out of time, but I think there's a tension. And Garrison Keillor, popularity. Stories are important. However, we start worshiping the story, we lose focus.
Yeah. Well, I certainly agree, and it's exactly because stories are powerful and are important that they need to be handled with care. And one of the challenges for a storyteller is to know what story to tell, when, and where. And the challenge for the listener is to know in what way this story is true. I believe that all stories are true. The problem is to determine for yourself in what way a particular story is true, or what the truth is there that you can take from the story and to know what you need to leave behind. And that's one of the things, it's been difficult for me. I spent 30 years as a pastor, and so I'm used to stories being used as weapons. A story, that's an arrow in your quiver. And it's something to move people to a particular viewpoint or a particular idea or thought. And to be able to step back a little bit and say, the story has a life of its own, and the story needs to be respected and honored for its own sake, and people need to be free to enter in and participate in that story in their own way. Stories, by the way, are dangerous, and I just want to close by giving you an example of the danger of stories. It happened about 4 years ago. I had a pumpkin at Halloween, and after Halloween was over, the pumpkin started to rot, so I took the pumpkin and I just fired it into the corner of my garden near a fence and forgot about it. And you can probably begin to reconstruct the scenario. The next spring, I had a pumpkin patch in the corner of my garden by the fence, and I watched those pumpkin vines, and a little ways into the summer, I noticed that one vine had begun to climb up the fence. And so I decided to leave it and to watch it. And by the middle of the summer, I had a pumpkin forming in one of the intersections of the fence. And by fall, it was a full-grown, ripe pumpkin, thoroughly trapped in the fence. And so I got out some shears, and I cut a hole in my fence.
No.
And I brought the pumpkin trapped in the fence to church Sunday morning to use for a sermon, children's sermon. And so I wrote the story of the little pumpkin who wouldn't listen. Little pumpkin woke up one day and he had this strange itchy feeling all over his body. And he asked his mother about it. And she said, oh, don't worry about it. That happens to every pumpkin. It just means that the time has come for you to grow and to explore in the garden. The garden is full of all kinds of wonderful things. And you can go anywhere you want in the garden.